You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda. And on today's episode, we'll be taking a little trip to Central Asia with Catherine Putz, our resident Central Asianist. Thanks for joining me, Katie. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
It's always good to have you on the show to talk Central Asia, which I know we don't do as much as we should on this podcast, but I'm always glad to have that part of Asia covered. It's, you know, oftentimes the forgotten part of the continent, even though it is the great heartland of Asia. So basically, for listeners, let me just outline how this podcast is going to go. We're actually not going to talk about the entire Central Asian region. We're going to focus mostly on Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan. As some of our readers may be aware, Uzbekistan really made huge headlines this past month, particularly because Islam Karimov, the country's first and only president since its independence from the Soviet Union, actually died. And it was a pretty uncertain death at some point. Actually, Katie, do we know exactly when he died?
It depends on if you're going to trust the state says he died on September 2nd.
Okay. But anyways, it was actually very dramatic. His death coincided with the 25th independence anniversary of the country. So he wasn't there, obviously, to live through that. And, you know, there were a lot of questions initially about how succession was going to go in the country, since, you know, Karimov was the Uzbek state in many ways. But Katie, you know, you wrote about this last week, and essentially your reading about, you know, your reading of matters in Uzbekistan was that things went better than expected. Is that a fair assessment?
I think they went, yeah. I guess if the, you know, the status quo is sort of good, I guess, in quotation marks.
Right.
Then yes, things could have gone a lot worse. I think when you think about regime change anywhere else in the world, where there's a sort of an established system, when one leader dies or the end of their term, there's a general process for how you pick the next guy.
Right.
Whether that's hereditary in monarchies or you have elections in democracies, there's a system, and so you don't think of the state as possibly fragile because the you know, top leader dies. In Uzbekistan, it was a different case, because it had never happened in Uzbekistan's 25 years of independence that mm-hmm. the leadership changed. So it was sort of, and it was an open question.
Okay. So, you know, a useful place to actually start with this would be, you know, what exactly happened? Karimov died, and then what?
Yeah, so around, I think it was like August 27th or 28th, the state actually put out an announcement that he had fallen ill, which was super shocking for all of the Central Asia watchers, because usually the state would deny these rumors. Karimov, over the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years, he would disappear for a couple weeks at a time, and there were rumors that he was either dead or he was sick. And the state always said, nope, he's in perfect health, everything's fine. So it was shocking that they admitted that he had fallen sick. And the general kind of consensus view on why they even admitted it was because the Uzbek independence anniversary was September 1st. And so they must have known that he was not well enough to make it to September 1st, whether he was going to recover or not, yada, 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 he wasn't going to be able to appear. And I think they made the judgment that it was less shocking to admit that he was sick and set everybody out for this transition than just wait until September 1st and then surprise he's not showing up and dancing and drinking like normal.
Mm-hmm.
So there was sort of this, you know, week of, well, is he dead? I had a diplomat in Bishkek actually ask me, well, do you think he's dead yet? I was like, shouldn't you know this? But he was the Uzbek state in a lot of ways, but I always kind of categorize Uzbekistan as kind of a mafia state. So the godfather died, and you have all of the lieutenants who, you know, they could either pick the new guy from the elite sort of cadre of people
right.
in power already. And that's kind of what happened. It's similar in a way to the transition that Turkmenistan went through in 2007 when their first president died.
Right.
There's the established constitutional process. So I think it's the chairman of the Senate is supposed to become the interim president in Uzbekistan. And this also happened in Turkmenistan. Well, Turkmenistan, the guy was sidelined. In Uzbekistan, the chairman of the Senate, after one day, I think it was, said, you know, I don't want to be interim president. You should make the guy who's prime minister, Shah, Shavkat Mirziyoyev. I'm going to have to practice saying that name for a long time because I'm really bad with names. Mirziyoyev. He's been the prime minister since 2003. He was a regional governor before that, essentially right-hand man of Karimov for a number of years. And so he was sort of held up as the next guy in charge. And shockingly, a couple days later, he was confirmed as the interim president. He's been nominated by the political party that always nominated Karimov to run in the election, which is going to be December 4th. So it's all of the pieces are being set up for Mirziyoyev to be the next president.
Mm-hmm. So let me take a step back because, you know, I said things went as well as they could have or went better than expected. But obviously, Karimov was not a nice guy. I mean, he leaves behind a legacy of, I think Casey put it well in his piece, which was a legacy of kleptocracy, slavery, and human rights abuses. I mean, we could go on and on about all the things that, you know, all the pain that Karimov has been responsible for in Uzbekistan. But my question is, you know, Mirziyoyev, this new guy on the scene, you said he was Karimov's right-hand man. So what's your sense of where, you know, Uzbekistan can expect to go? I mean, basically, are we going to expect continuity on pretty much most fronts, you know, especially when it comes to things like governance, human rights, being open to the rest? You know, is Uzbekistan still going to hew closer to Russia? What's your take?
I think you're going to see Uzbekistan hew actually a little bit closer to Russia. Karimov liked to be his own man a lot of the times and would kind of, if you look at sort of the example of he took Uzbekistan out of the CSTO twice because he didn't really like other people telling him what to do. So I think you'll see the country hew a little bit closer to Russia than it has. But by and large, from what I've been told by other analysts who follow Uzbekistan much more closely than I have, Mirziyoyev is very much in the vein of Karimov, if not worse. He's apparently a pretty aggressive, thuggish kind of figure. I think I was reading Bruce Panier said that he's more of a fist than a brain.
Right.
So if you could think of Karimov as this kind of clever guy who put all of these pieces together. So whatever bad things I could say about Karimov, he was incredibly clever. But Mirziyoyev seems to be a little bit more brawn, and that could bode even worse. As a regional governor, he was part of the whole apparatus that gets the cotton harvest taken in. So he was part of that system of sort of oppression and forced slavery and things like that. And so, I mean, on all of the human rights factors, I don't see any of that getting any better. I think you'll see Uzbekistan be a little bit closer to Russia. But by and large, the system that Karimov sort of set up wants to sustain itself.
Right.
And so these powerful figures, and there are a couple other sort of nodes of power that are part of Mirziyoyev isn't like the ultimate boss. There are a couple other nodes, particularly the head of the National Security Service and the SNB. He's an incredibly powerful figure, but likes to sit in the background. And
right.
So these guys have managed it in a way that will see them sort of perpetuate the system that has allowed them to enrich themselves.
Exactly. Perpetuate the kleptocracy, essentially. I think, yeah, the mafia state description really, you know, helps explain what to expect here. I guess one final question I have about Uzbekistan, and this is actually a bit of a segue into Kyrgyzstan, is one of the developments, you know, we saw in August that you wrote about was a sharp decline in relations along the border between the two countries. Obviously, they don't get along for a variety of reasons. Do you think Mirziyoyev, because he is this more, you know, he's a guy to maybe punch first, ask questions later. Do you think that maybe bodes poorly for Uzbekistan's relationship, not only with Kyrgyzstan, but with its other neighbors as well?
We'll see. Because so there was a little border tiff, and the same area was the subject of tensions last spring. There's a mountain and a reservoir involved and sort of issues, so sort of legacy issues of the Soviet division and how they had done development and things like that. And he pulled back the troops that were annoying the Kyrgyz and released the four like technicians who had been detained. And so it seems they've backed off from this, but I don't know how much that tells us about going forward, how he's going to treat that border. Mirziyoyev didn't go to the CIS summit that was in Bishkek. on the 16th. All the other regional heads were there. He didn't go. And that makes sense. You know, he's like a week into the new job. I guess not going to another country is reasonable in a way, but that can be interpreted pretty poorly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it was. And so Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, I think, are going to continue to have these problems. They're multifaceted. They're not just about borders. It's about ethnicity in some areas. It's about old legacy issues. Water is a huge irritant in this whole problem. So I don't see it getting any better. I don't think he's going to be a better negotiator with Kyrgyzstan in terms of finally settling some of these border issues. I don't see the diplomacy aspect getting any better, but he has the opportunity to. He is new in charge, so it's possible,
right.
But I'm not terribly hopeful that those issues will settle themselves. I also don't, for a while I was thinking maybe he would, this is sort of my speculation, I was thinking maybe he would try to, you know, make his mark by pushing the issue, but I don't really think that that's the most likely thing.
Right. I mean, it sounds like, some of the, I'm going to use the example of North Korea just because it comes to mind as another mafia state where, especially with Kim Jong-un's accession, there was early on in his term, there was a lot of talk about power consolidation. From what I'm understanding from you in Uzbekistan, that really doesn't seem to be the play because most of these elites agree that, stability is the best course of action to keep their position secure.
To an extent, there have been a couple of shuffles within the cabinet, some administrative shuffling, which is just a regional pastime, happens all the time for random reasons. And so there were a couple old faces that were brought in back into the cabinet. Mirziyoyev dismissed the head of Jizaka City, which was the region that he had been governor of, and then replaced him with the former head of Tashkent City, who had been fired by Karimov. Mm-hmm. Probably for corruption. So there's sort of you get the sense that he's kind of bringing back in people that that he liked in those positions and pushing a couple people away. But the major figures have mostly stayed. Particularly the finance minister is still the finance minister, and his portfolio was actually expanded. He was given more responsibilities.
Right.
So and that had the feeling of kind of a deal. You know, like we'll give you a little bit more control over these things. Yeah, I get to be the top head. The security guy gets to stay in his gray cardinal position and everybody continues as normal. So there's sort of small changes, but this was the consolidated elite, so I don't know how much further you could go with it.
Exactly. Yeah, actually what you just described, sounded more like the Chinese power plays with the multiple cliques of leadership.
Yeah.
So that's also interesting. All right, Katie, go ahead.
And the last thing I just want to say on that is There are some clan dynamics in Uzbekistan also, particularly Samarkand and Tashkent. And so some of these guys are from different clans. So there's sort of this balance that they've achieved between different levels and different kinds of power nodes. So it's, the mafia state description is the best for how those different levels interact with each other and how they're set up.
All right. Yeah, great. Well, thanks a lot for that very helpful rundown of the situation in Uzbekistan after Karimov's transition. All right, so let's talk about Kyrgyzstan, which is where you were for how many days?
I think it was 17 total.
Okay, that's a good amount of time.
Travel days on the end.
Right.
Took forever.
Not an easy place to get to. But Katie, let's talk a bit about this country. I mean, so we talked a bit about Kyrgyzstan's relations with Uzbekistan, but obviously, Kyrgyzstan is an entity all onto itself. So, the highlight of your visit, seems to have been the World Nomad Games. And here actually might be a good place for you to plug the upcoming issue of the magazine, which you work very closely on. But tell us a bit about the World Nomad Games.
So in 2014, and I'm not entirely certain how the idea got started. Part of it was, I think, from the Turkic Council. But Kyrgyzstan decided to host this event called the World Nomad Games. The best way to describe it to Westerners has been to say, do you know what the Scottish Highland Games are? It's kind of like that, but for nomadic peoples. And then you combine that with this big festival, which has the flavor of a Renaissance festival, just with nomads. and everything's better with Nomad. So it was a tremendous amount of fun. I certainly could get into the politics and the money, and there's the way that people criticize the Olympics, you can criticize the World Nomad Games, but it's a massive sporting event. And some of the sports are a little bit more serious than others. The wrestling sports are a little bit more serious because they're part of more global competitions. And then some of the games like Kokpuru, which is what Kyrgyz call, what the Afghans call Buzkashi.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got another name in Kazakhstan, but all three of those consider it their national sport. So that is a really exciting game. So there were horse games, there were hunting games.
Cool. Can you give us a sense of scale of the whole event? I mean, so how many, let's start with how many sports, how many people come to spectate, and, security you talked about was a big presence. So talk a bit about that as well.
Yeah. So there were, I believe this year, there were 23 sports. I think the original had half that number. There were 23 sports. The Hippodrome, which is where the horse events were held, is brand new. They had finished it, from what I've been told, literally days before the game started. That seated 10,000. We started counting sections just to see if that seemed, we meaning the press group that I was with, were counting seats to see if we could see whether it was actually 10,000. It seemed like it was actually 10,000 seats, and for the opening it was full. And it was full for the Kokpuru final between Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan. So there were about 10,000 people at that stadium. The cultural events were up in a mountain pass called Jilo, called Kirchin Gorge. And so that had over 200 yurts were set up. Each of the regions of Kyrgyzstan had a little yurt village, and they mm-hmm. were putting on performances and had food. And it was just a big field festival. And so it was a pretty big scale. Most of the attendees were Kyrgyz. I would say there was a good number of Kazakhs and Russians around also. I think they said there were over 50 countries participating, and you could tell a difference between which countries were participating with a little bit more serious intent and which ones might have been backpackers press ganged into representing their country.
Right.
So the French team looked like four backpackers, but the Kazakh team all had matching jackets.
Right.
and the Hungarians showed up in traditional dress, and sort of the German team, which looked like three backpackers, but they were wearing lederhosen.
Okay.
So there was a great variety of things, but there was a lot of people there.
Okay. And so, countries obviously put on events like this usually with a purpose in mind. You know, it's not mm-hmm. it's not something for nothing. So what's Kyrgyzstan hoping to get out of the World Nomad Games?
Primarily, I would say they're working to boost their tourism industry. And I talk a little bit about this in the upcoming magazine. I write one of the leads, and I go a little bit more into the politics and the commercialization of the games and some of the sort of rough edges, you could say. But the purpose of doing something like this is to promote Kyrgyzstan. But what they would say is that this is to promote nomadic culture, and there is an element to that. You know, it is to promote nomadic culture mm-hmm. and that region of the world. But at the end you get a sense that it's very Kyrgyz, and that all of the hunting game winners were all Kyrgyz because there's not a lot of other people who are hunting with eagles still.
So, right, yeah.
So there's the sort of headline reason, which would be the promotion of nomadic cultures, and they definitely did that. And that, there were unique things about the games that were uniquely Kyrgyz and certainly celebrated Kyrgyz culture, but a lot of that is also applicable to the rest of Eurasia. And so that's sort of the headline thing, but Kyrgyzstan doesn't have a lot of natural resources to export aside other than gold, which is a big irritant. They do have gorgeous mountains and friendly people, and have the good sort of building blocks of a tourism industry. And so I think this is part of that sort of global promotion.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense.
Yep.
So just a final question, which was, you know, you went to Central Asia at an exciting time. I believe a few days before the event started, there was a bombing at the Chinese embassy in Bishkek. So security in Kyrgyzstan, I imagine, must have been pretty high for this event and just, you know, surrounding everything.
Yeah. So I got to Bishkek on the 27th. And like 2 days later, there was a bombing at the Chinese embassy, which is on the far southern corner of the city, actually catty corner to the U.S. embassy. So the first report that I had read about it right after it happened was a bombing at the U.S. embassy, because they're literally right behind each other. But what had happened was a guy drove a van through one of the gates and detonated a bomb. An incredibly inept suicide bombing, because the only person that died was the bomber himself. It did a bunch of damage to the Chinese embassy, injured three workers, Kyrgyz workers at the embassy. But you know, on the scale of sort of terrorist acts, very inept. The Kyrgyz and the Chinese say that this was a Uyghur terrorist. And there was something about they had a Tajik passport on them. So there's sort of a lot of questions, but not a lot of answers on specifically who this was and exactly why they were bombing the Chinese embassy. But it was like 2 days before Kyrgyzstan's Independence Day celebration. So right. The city was already crawling with security. And then Independence Day was a lot of police. Had to turn on my camera to show that it worked and wasn't a bomb to get into the square. And I think they were already planning on having a lot of security at the Nomad Games, but that further pushed the numbers. The numbers that I got from what the Kyrgyz sent us, like a press release saying all the details or whatever, and they said it was like 7,700 police and military and internal security there, and I believe those numbers. And so that's 7,700 for a sports venue that seats 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, getting into the stadium was interesting. They had sort of police with their funny round hats stationed like every 5 feet, and, you know, had to go all the way down to one end to get in. And then the press entrance was on the exact opposite end. And so it was sort of a bit of a runaround to get in. But there was a lot of security, but you got the sense that it looked like a lot of security, but they didn't all know what was going on. So I don't know how effective sort of saturation with a bunch of cops who don't all know what the plan is.
Right.
But it was interesting, and nothing bad happened at the games. I didn't see any incidents. It was just kind of irritating. If you went in one gate, they would search your bag very thoroughly. If you went in a different gate, they wouldn't care at all. So it was sort of a little, you know, luck of the draw.
Yeah.
With your former.
Sounds honestly a bit like the TSA here in the United States.
Yeah, that's about it.
Well, I mean, you know, that's actually, you know, it's a security theater. I mean, if you're putting on a big international event, you want to make everyone feel safe, so you go overboard on pulling
security
all your guns.
Theater is probably the right word for that. But you know, they were concerned, though. I think their concerns were a little bit. Nobody wanted to attack the World Nomad Games,
right?
But. Yeah, it was definitely interesting. One last thing about the bombing in Bishkek is that kind of thing doesn't happen very often in Bishkek,
right?
Or in Kyrgyzstan, and frankly, in most of Central Asia. There's sort of this overarching narrative that you know, there's lots of terrorists running around and it's very dangerous, and then that's not doesn't really match up with reality. There have been a few like incidents, but it's sometimes hard to tell whether they're criminal incidences or terrorists. And there's not a lot of transparency in the investigation, so you never really figure these things out.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of this, obviously, it was some kind of terrorist incident. Exactly what their motivation was is still you can go with the most likely, which is what they're going with, but.
Yeah, no, that's an important corrective, especially when you read, you know, a lot of generalist analysis of phenomena like the Islamic State, and you'll hear, you know, all sorts of paranoia about Central Asia turning into this hotbed for Islamic Jihad, and obviously you ask Central Asian and they'll tell you that is absolutely not the case.
Yeah, it's not that those elements don't exist, it's just that they get talked about to such a degree that they seem much larger than they are in reality.
Right.
So it's a very annoying careful line to walk to say yes, there are there are people who have joined ISIS from Central Asia, and there are people who certainly have ill intent within these countries. But you can say that of nearly every country in the world, so it's sort of not a helpful thing to say. But it is, you know, a little bit more clickbaity to say it's the next hotbed of, you know, it's the second front.
Yeah, and you know, maybe it doesn't help that all the countries end with Stan, because the, you know, Afghanistan and Pakistan are probably the two best known Asian stands, and they rightfully are do have their problems with terrorism. So I think a lot of that gets lumped onto the Central Asian states without much justification.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, you say something that ends in Stan, and they might know which section of the world just because of Afghanistan and Pakistan, but they don't really know much beyond that.
Right. Well, hopefully, you know, some of our listeners
we'll try
to this
help.
Podcast. Yeah, exactly. At The Diplomat, at least, our Central Asia coverage has really expanded. So hopefully we keep on pushing the envelope there. Well, Katie, thanks a lot for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolute pleasure. And just final note for listeners, don't forget to subscribe and do rate and review us on iTunes. That really helps the podcast. And as usual, if you want to hear something on the show that you haven't heard yet, feel free to ping me on Twitter or via email, and I'd be happy to add it to the schedule going forward. Thanks for listening.